Morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Norfleet versus Webster and Hattie.
May it please the court, my name is Edward Himmelfarb with the Department of Justice. This is a qualified immunity appeal on behalf of Alejandro Hedayat, a physician's assistant, and Dr. Thomas Webster, a doctor at Terre Haute. The district court denied both men qualified immunity on the ground that a jury could find on the merits that they had been deliberately indifferent to a federal inmate's medical needs. The court was wrong. First, with respect to P.A. Hedayat, Hedayat is accused of refusing to give Norfleet his refill of naproxen on the basis of a written medical policy that was in effect at the institution.
Now, I just wanted to make sure, certainly from your point of view, no one is making a frontal attack on this directive, which appears at the last page of the opening brief here, that NSAIDs for all prisoners in all times need to have a break.
That's correct. Nobody's made the district.
No one is talking about that. They're only talking about whether physician's assistant Hadid himself had to follow this.
That's correct. The district court did not say it was unconstitutional, did not say it was blatantly illegal in any way.
My question is, why is this a federal case?
I beg your pardon?
My question is, why is this a federal case? I mean, what is the downside to the prison letting him wear the soft-soled shoes that he purchased himself and that he had worn in other prisons?
Your Honor, I think the interesting thing about the soft shoe allegation is that there are really two ways it comes up in this case. The first way is really not even on appeal because it had to do with the confiscation of his shoes early on during his tenure at Terre Haute. He had been allowed to wear them after a senator intervened at FCI Milan. When he was transferred, he did not have the authorization, and they were confiscated. The district court ruled in favor of the defendants on the confiscation claim. That part of the case is not on appeal. That's the first part. The second part is in July 2002, Dr. Webster did an evaluation of Norfleet. And what he said at the end of the evaluation was that Norfleet should be wearing wide-box steel-toed shoes. Now, the issue about steel-toed shoes in a prison is for the prisoner's work assignment. Certain work assignments, in fact, the majority, as I understand, the majority of work assignments require protective shoes like that. And so that's basically what the question is here. There's no evidence in the record that Norfleet ever had a work assignment in which he was, in fact, required to wear these shoes. Those are really the only two areas in which the soft shoe allegation is relevant here. One is out of the case because it had to do with the confiscation, and the other is that this was not really pursued because he doesn't allege in this case that he was forced to wear these. Dr. Webster did evaluate him and did say he should be wearing these, but he doesn't. Norfleet does not continue to allege that he didn't have soft sole shoes.
And sort of following, I suppose, in Judge Wood's question, I was really wondering how the policy regarding the NSAIDs can be constitutional in that it determines the medication to be given to inmates on a blanket basis without any regard, it would seem, to individual needs and without any opportunity for the inmate to see a doctor before the medication is cut off. In other words, why wouldn't the inmate be given a chance to get an individualized determination from a doctor as to whether the break from the NSAIDs would be harmful to that individual before the policy was applied to them? I can't imagine any other circumstance in which a prison could arbitrarily decide that all inmates will receive a 3 to 7 day break from their medications before they can see a doctor.
Your Honor, I think there are two aspects of this policy. One is that there was concern. In fact, the court could really take judicial notice of the fact that there's currently concern about the unbroken use of NSAIDs. And the idea was to break, as Your Honor mentioned, to break the continuous use. And the second is the way it was dispensed at the prison.
Just to follow up on Judge Rovner for a moment, it can be one thing that certain substances could be abused or that for some people are not appropriate. I can think of all sorts of substances that might be abused in the wrong hands. On the other hand, there are some patients who have chronic problems for which a doctor might, in that particular instance, think that the balance of harm falls in the side of giving a continuous prescription. As Judge Rovner says, it's a case-by-case determination, and this policy certainly doesn't seem to leave any room for case-by-case determinations. I think some doctors would think people with chronic pain might need a continuous course of NSAIDs.
Well, Your Honor, you know, the problem here, as I was mentioning, the second issue that was addressed by the policy is how they were dispensed. And the problem that the higher-ups in the healthcare at Terre Haute saw was that the inmates were coming in and not seeing anybody and were automatically being given an unbroken supply of these drugs. And they wanted to make sure that a sick call was scheduled to make sure that somebody, a doctor, was able to see the prisoners before they were before the prescription was continued. So that's a second aspect of the policy. I would also say that nobody, the plaintiff here, Northfleet, does not challenge the constitutionality of this policy.
Right.
And more important than that, Your Honor, is that the issue here is qualified immunity, and the question is, with a physician's assistant in the position of Haddad, think that this policy, have to believe this policy was so obviously constitutional they had to ignore it. He was in a position, the policy applied to him, he was required to follow the policy. He can't be punished in damages for following a policy that was not obviously unconstitutional. Perhaps if this court were to find that it was unconstitutional, even though, with respect, I don't believe it's an issue in the case, if the court were to find it unconstitutional, it still could not allow damages to be assessed against him for following the policy that was mandatory.
What about Dr. Webster? Sorry. Mr. Norfleet has any kind of arthritis, one of the things he's going to need is an anti-inflammatory of some kind. Should a doctor be excused for thinking that Tylenol is an anti-inflammatory, which I assure you it is not?
No, Your Honor, but what we're talking about here, based on the undisputed record in this case, we're talking about an individual with a relatively low level of arthritis. We can dispute, Dr. Webster disputes the particular type of arthritis that's involved in this case, but basically...
Well, he never actually says it's osteoarthritis. You introduced that into your brief. And, rheumatoid arthritis is something that gets worse over time, so the time to treat it is before it gets irreparably advanced.
We can really ignore... Your Honor, I'd be happy for the court to ignore the issue of osteoarthritis. The reason we said that is that there are two major kinds of arthritis that affect the joints that Norfleet is affected by. Dr. Webster said it's not rheumatoid arthritis. The other one is there's arthritis.
We don't know if he thought that or if he didn't really think anything was wrong. Mm-hmm. We do know that the specialist speaking in terms of rheumatoid arthritis.
That's
Dr.
right.
Sue.
And we know that Dr. Webster agreed that there was arthritis, but that he didn't believe it was rheumatoid. But we can... I'm perfectly willing to assume here, solely for these purposes, that it, in fact, was rheumatoid arthritis. But all the medical records here indicate, including Dr. Sue's report, all the medical indicates a relatively low level of rheumatoid arthritis.
But all I'm saying is, would it be considered proper medical practice to look at somebody with an early stage of rheumatoid arthritis and say, we're just not going to treat you. We're going to give you, something that's completely ineffective for inflammation, namely Tylenol, and just not treat you and wait until you become crippled before we do anything, even if it takes 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. I don't know how long it would take.
Your Honor, I think you raised an interesting point about what proper medical practice, because this case is a deliberate indifference case. It does not really involve proper medical practice.
But I'm trying to get at whether it does. If a if a physician who thinks that somebody has rheumatoid arthritis just decides no treatment, no painkiller, no treatment, is that, in fact, deliberate indifference, a conscious decision not to treat?
No, I think if it's a medical judgment, this court has said that the question really is whether medical judgment was exercised. And it could be malpractice not to give any kind of medical treatment based on rheumatoid arthritis, but it's not necessarily deliberate indifference because if it's a medical judgment that's being exercised, then it's not deliberate indifference.
So you think if a general practitioner like Dr. Webster is just an ignoramus when it comes to rheumatoid arthritis, and he thinks it's fine not to treat anybody...
By the way, Your Honor, I'm sorry to interrupt. He did treat that.
With Tylenol and with all these breaks, and then the naproxen gets canceled, and all sorts of other things happen. At some point, as you understand, the line between what we like to call mere medical malpractice in the prisons and deliberate indifference gets crossed. And if a doctor looks at a record and says, "I'm not going to treat this with the kinds of treatments that are typical for rheumatoid arthritis," when does one reach that line?
Well, I think the way you reach that line, I think if you look at some of the cases from this circuit, the way you reach that line is whether the doctor was exercising or the nurse was exercising medical judgment or was saying, "I don't like you, prisoner. You're a pain in the neck, and I'm not going to give you your medication." That's Walker against Benjamin, for example. Mm-hmm. A doctor who is ordered to by a specialist to give a specific drug and says not to give a specific drug, and he does anyway, that's pretty close to deliberate indifference. But
it seemed to me, unless I missed something, that there was even a failure, or at least it was alleged, a failure to even provide him with the Tylenol.
What happened during that first period that the policy was in effect, we misinterpreted, as we said in our reply brief, we misinterpreted what the district court said, that Haddad actually apparently did not give him Tylenol at that time. The Tylenol was given later on, but Tylenol is an over-the-counter drug, and there's nothing in here that suggests that it was not otherwise available to Norfleet. So that was a limited period of time in any event.
Yeah, well, of course, a limited period of time can be the difference between enormous pain and no pain.
That's right, Your Honor. But that was not Dr. Webster who denied him Tylenol. If anybody, it was Haddad, and his actions were limited by the policy, at least with respect to the naproxen.
Well, the policy doesn't address Tylenol.
No, the policy does not address Tylenol.
The NSAIDs.
No, ma'am, it does not. That's correct.
If the policy is unconstitutional, who would the proper defendant be in your view?
If there were a claim that the policy was unconstitutional?
Right.
I guess the proper defendant would be the people who wrote the policy, which is an official not in this case, and Dr. Webster. This case does not allege any claim against Dr. Webster based on the policy, though. It's against Haddad, the PA, and he was required to follow it, and he's entitled to qualified immunity as a result. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Jan Michelson. I'm an attorney at Ogletree Deacons, Nash, Smoak, and Stewart in Indianapolis, but today I'm appearing as appointed counsel for the plaintiff, appellee Armin Norfleet. I was appointed to assist Mr. Norfleet with his case after summary judgment had been denied on the issue of qualified immunity against Dr. Webster and P.A. Haddad. Mr. Norfleet had filed a lawsuit complaining that various prison officials violated his Eighth Amendment right to be free of cruel and unusual punishment in the form of their deliberate indifference to his serious medical needs.
Now, Ms. Michelson, did you provide any evidence that Norfleet communicated to Dr. Webster the pain difference with soft-soled shoes as opposed to steel-toed shoes?
Mr. Norfleet was assigned because of his condition to the chronic care clinic, where they are seen every 3 months, I believe. And in all of those visits, when he was able to see Dr. Webster, in some of those cases, I believe he just sees the physician's assistant, he complained about all the aspects of his condition that were bothering him, his pain, his stiffening joints, his and was well aware of that.
Is there any evidence in the record from medical authorities as to the basic standard of care for a person with minimal rheumatoid arthritis, and specifically any evidence that soft-soled shoes are required to meet that standard of care, or that certain medications are required?
Your Honor, actually, Dr. Webster admitted in one of his declarations that there really is no such medical thing as mild minimal arthritis. Although he uses that term in terms of explaining why it is not rheumatoid arthritis, Mr. Norfleet's prison records, medical records, which supposedly are accurate, as they would follow him to another institution, for example, and he would be treated on the basis of those, are replete with notations and instances by pharmacists, by Dr. Webster himself, by physician's assistants, that he suffers from rheumatoid arthritis, or at least shows the symptoms of that rheumatoid arthritis.
A lot of those records equivocate, though. I mean, they sort of say, assuming for the sake of argument, or I would paraphrase, but they, I looked at them and found it hard to find something that was just a square diagnosis from a physician. Mm-hmm. This is rheumatoid arthritis. This is what has to happen. Certainly not Dr. Sue, the specialist. He kind of talks around the problem.
Right. And Dr. Sue, the Mr. Norfleet was referred out to him, and Dr. Sue then makes his recommendations back to the prison doctors. And the prison doctors in Milan took his recommendation. They instituted the Plaquenil.
I understand that, but my point is different. Dr. Sue doesn't even really say, this patient has rheumatoid arthritis, mm-hmm. this is what you should do. He just makes some suggestions, which presumably the other doctors were free to either follow or not. If he had wanted to dictate, plenty of referring physicians dictate.
Well, Mr. Norfleet is not claiming a particular treatment was denied him, but the fact that the record is equivocal, and I think Dr. Webster even argues, you know, it was a difference of opinion, the fact that he admits that and then did nothing. He didn't do a blood test. He didn't take additional x-rays.
Well, did nothing more. You know, he did continue the naproxen prescription. He does see him regularly. He does keep up with the case. And your opponent argues that as long as he's doing something, at least for qualified immunity purposes, you can't show deliberate indifference.
Well, I don't think that that's what the law says, that doing something is not necessarily enough. If, in fact, in the deliberate indifference standard obviously is objective in terms of the serious medical need, but subjective in did he know the risk and did he ignore it? There were so many signs that he should be doing something, or at least confirming that it wasn't, and then in which case he could do nothing or he could change his medications.
But why aren't you describing at worst medical malpractice, that he should have done some tests that he didn't do? But it's not like, you know, Mr. Norfleet was lying on the floor in agony, or in some of these extreme cases where we have seen deliberate indifference.
Well, I think that Mr. Norfleet, A, was suffering pain, which is can be considered, and also what he wasn't doing was putting him at risk for further deterioration. And that, ignoring that risk, not just what was happening to him right now, but the fact that letting him go for 3 years without even doing a blood test, not even taking x-rays so that he could say definitively, yes, he has mild arthritis. I don't think he needs these shoes. I don't think he needs Plaquenil.
But that means you think that seeing him every 3 months and coming to a medical diagnosis that he doesn't need extra treatment, whether rightly or wrongly, counts as a matter of law, as deliberate indifference. You know, that you didn't order a blood test, ergo deliberate indifferent. Didn't order x-rays, ergo deliberate indifferent.
In the face of a specialist's recommendations, which had been implemented by two prison doctors, in the face of the patient's continuing complaints about his pain, in the case of physician's assistants at the prison pleading with Dr. Webster to be able to give him the naproxen, Mr. Norfleet was lucky that he had some advocates in the institution to be able to get that. In the face of all that, and in the face of the most recent diagnosis, although, as you said, it was not specific, he has rheumatoid arthritis, but it gave recommendations by a rheumatologist who knows by looking at a patient and looking at their record something about rheumatoid arthritis. That was the most recent suggestion recommendation. Dr. Webster says, well, there was a negative blood test back in 2001, and at one time a prison doctor said he couldn't have soft-shelled shoes. That's true. That was in the past. That's like saying, I don't have cancer today, but, you know, I have cancer in 3 months, and we'll look back and he'll say, you didn't have cancer today. He had needed to rely or at least explore the most recent diagnosis by a specialist. And if Dr. Webster was just seeing Mr. Norfleet on a regular basis, not doing any tests, his only method would be sort of visual inspection.
I'd like to talk about Haddad for just a moment. I'm very troubled, as I think is pretty obvious, about this the blanket prohibition that really doesn't take into consideration any individual needs of prisoners. You know, some of whom might suffer very serious consequences from this enforced break. I can understand the prison's concern with the long-term effects of NACEDs. I mean, that's understandable. The idea that they make medical decisions for prisoners as a group with no concern for individual needs and no opportunity for the prisoners to see a doctor before the needs are cut off is very troubling. That said, Haddad did not create the policy.
Correct.
And Norfleet apparently has not sued those who did. And maybe you can help me with that.
Well, and Mr. Norfleet has not alleged that the policy is unconstitutional. Our understanding of the policy, and I think it's been misunderstood, is it was a means. What was happening is that prisoners were coming to RNs and saying, I need some more drugs. The RNs were giving it to the physician's assistant without the physician's assistant ever seeing the patient, and they, without making the correct entry into the medical record, the SOAP, all the aspects that needed to be recorded. They wanted to keep the RNs from bypassing the physician's assistant. Mr. Norfleet was seeing a physician's assistant. He was seeing physician's assistant Haddad, and there was nothing in that policy that would have kept Mr. Physician's assistant Haddad from giving him 7 days worth of naproxen refills. Nothing in there that would have let him do that. Nothing that said he couldn't give him Tylenol. As a matter of fact, Tylenol is not available in their commissary. He was seeing a physician assistant. So he was not one of these people who, because he was in the chronic care clinic, who could bypass and just stay on forever. He, in fact, had been taking naproxen for a very long time, and, in fact, had been taking Plaquenil for some period of time before it was discontinued as soon as he came to Terre Haute. This did not bar Haddad from giving him a prescription without seeing him in sick call. This was not the situation that policy was intended to eliminate.
Well, I think you're reading the policy pretty tightly. I mean, in terms of qualified immunity, to call Haddad culpable for something that's for following a policy that says it's addressed to all medical staff, which certainly would include a physician's assistant, and then says that they can only have 7 days, no refills, and ends up by saying we'll force the inmate to take a break off the medication, read fairly reasonably, it seems that that would prevent Haddad from doing this. But there, I see no way to hold him responsible for the fact that somebody else in the Bureau of Prisons bureaucracy decided to do this, however ill-advised it may have been. Surely it's not Haddad.
Well, although Mr. Haddad could have renewed Mr. Northfleet's prescriptions for 7 days and got him in to see a physician, could have given him Tylenol, this is not even, you know, in the prison there are these various levels. This is not even a policy. It was a memorandum, and there needed to be some additional paperwork needed to happen to make that kind of a permanent issue. And, in fact, Mr. Haddad gave Mr. Northfleet those continuing pain medications for many more than 7 days subsequently.
Well,
with regard to Dr. Webster, isn't it? Couldn't we look at this as merely a different diagnosis and made by the people at Mylan?
That is Dr. Webster's argument, but it is more than a different diagnosis. It is in the face of specialist opinion, in the face of what two other prison doctors had done, in the face of a patient's own reports of pain, which can be taken into consideration. Obviously, you only can know what the person can tell you in terms of pain. He did nothing. I mean, he said, I have an equivocal record here. I'm not sure whether it's osteoarthritis, and there's no such thing as mild minimal arthritis, and the record is full of documentation that it's rheumatoid arthritis. Those records have rheumatoid arthritis already through them, but refused to be sure of that and rather put Mr. Northfleet at risk by something that would be very simple to do, send him to an outside specialist, which was done before and could have been done again. My time is up.
Not quite. Not really.
There was a motion to strike filed in this case. You want to address that just briefly?
Certainly. And we did file a response. The motion to strike dealt with facts occurring after the summary judgment was decided. And I think the two facts that maybe that related to were the cessation of the naproxen, which did occur later on. But the other, most of the motion to strike was appealing the fact that it was mentioned that Dr. Webster continued to not do things. And my point in the response, and my response to that motion to strike would be, it doesn't matter. When we argue that he never did a blood test, he never did it up to the time of the summary judgment filing. He never did x-rays. He never gave him the shoes. He never sent him to a specialist. That is certainly sufficient in terms of the deliberate indifference claim, and certainly in terms of the qualified immunity claim, which is really the only claim.
Then you don't have any objection to granting the motion to strike?
To the extent that it affects only those things which truly were not occurring before the summary judgment. Mr. Northfleet was pro se. He didn't, unfortunately, know to amend his complaint to add those. My other point in the response was, if that in fact is the case, then he would need to be amending on a daily basis to say he didn't give me naproxen today, and I'm going to amend it tomorrow to say he didn't give me naproxen tomorrow if he wants to keep the record up to date. And that seems to be not a very efficient process. But all of the things that are alleged, and the motion to strike suggests that we're relying on things that were not alleged, all of those things were alleged in the period of time between him coming to Terre Haute and the summary judgment being briefed and Judge Hamilton's making the decision on the summary judgment. There's nothing.
Your time is now up.
Thank you.
How much time?
1.5 minutes.
I have two quick points now. One is that this discussion of Dr. Webster's alleged failure to order tests is really part of the case that's now that was raised for the first time on appeal. That was not raised below. Second thing is that even if it were true, that's a question of medical malpractice. It's a medical judgment whether you take tests or not. That's at worst medical malpractice. It's not deliberate indifference. And also, if the court looks at Dr. Sue's report, Dr. Sue didn't take tests either. He relied on these allegedly old tests also. The second point is that we've heard a little bit about Plaquenil. I think if the court's interested, I can try to explain a little bit about that to the best of my knowledge. The record is this is a very puzzling aspect of the case, even to me. What happened was, what's undisputed in this case is that Dr. Sue recommended that Plaquenil on a trial basis be administered to Norfleet. This is when he was still at the former institution, wasn't at Terre Haute yet. It's also undisputed that they did start the Plaquenil treatment at Milan, at FCI Milan. It's undisputed that when, in May 2002, when Norfleet was brought to Terre Haute, that Dr. Webster was not even employed at Terre Haute at the time. They did an intake at Terre Haute. They listed all of his medications. For some reason, I have no idea why, Plaquenil is not listed on the intake. This is before Dr. Webster was at Terre Haute. And that's basically the end of the Plaquenil. There's no further discussion of Plaquenil in the record. It wasn't Dr. Webster's decision to discontinue Plaquenil. It wasn't on the medical records when Norfleet arrived at Terre Haute.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.